Thank you all for coming out. Why don't we get started? It's a pleasure to be hosting Haida Julevitz in my Books and Brews series. For those of you who haven't been here before, the series, we host a reading and a Q&A in this room, and then we'll host a signing in the bookstore. And then after the signing, all of you are invited to go down the street to this lovely restaurant and bar, Ariadne, where we kind of overtake the bar in an after party, and they usually have complimentary appetizers. Bookstore buys your first round, and you leave fulfilled and happy. Heidi is, among many things, she's a founding editor of, one of the founding editors of The Believer. She's the author of three novels, including The Mineral Palace, The Effect of Living Backwards, and the collaborative book Hotel Andromeda. She's here tonight in celebration of her latest novel, The Uses of Enchantment, which is one of our favorite novels this year. It's been praised by many reviewers and authors. One of my favorite, A.M. Holmes, called it her best book yet, a tightly wound ball of yarn, a yarn of family, of female adolescence, sexuality, experimentation, and all that could have been, might have been, and therefore must have been. Her graceful, evocative prose leads the reader down a never-ending path, mysterious and dreamy. This book is on the pulse of where we are now, the blur between memory and fantasy, between fact and fiction, between knowing and not knowing what we are. It's a great honor to have her here. Just please help me welcome Haida Julevitz.
It's actually with great terror that I am here, because this book is set around this area, and my first book was set in Pueblo, which was kind of near Colorado. When I read in Colorado, I looked out in the audience, and there was this sort of like this line of really angry looking old people that were sitting in the back of the room, and I just thought, that's a sort of strange demographic for me, but okay, you know, that's cool. I'm glad I'm sort of reaching a whole bunch of different people. And and afterwards they just attacked me for like, well, that street doesn't intersect that street, and that street doesn't, you know. I got seriously schooled. I got a geography lesson. Anyway, so feel free to give me a geography lesson if you want. I can always use one afterwards. So basically, this book is, every time I try to explain it, I make it sound more complicated than it is. It's not that complicated. And essentially, the basis of it is there is a girl named Mary Veal. She's 17 or 16 years old. I can't even remember. We changed the age so many times. She's either 16 or 17. And she disappears from her field hockey match. And you later very quickly learn that she has sort of engineered her own abduction. And then she goes to a therapist when she reappears, and she tells him one story of what happened to her, but this is kind of a lie. And then he sort of imposes his own interpretation of her story. So then we have like a second version of the story. And then a third therapist gets involved, and she doubts the version of the other therapist. So suddenly this woman who has kind of, in theory, gone to therapy to kind of understand her past, her past has now been fractured into 100 different directions, and you see her sort of as an adult, and she is sort of, in fact, ruined by the fact that she is kind of this person without a discernible past. Anyways, it is told in three sections. I'm really totally on the fence right now, actually. I'm about to flip a coin. I can't decide which section to read. I can either read what I've read a lot already, which is, means I will be bored, or I can read you something new, which I don't know if this is like actually even any good. So you might be bored. I think I'm going to risk boring you tonight. So this is actually from near the beginning. She has returned home. It's now 14 years after she disappeared, and she's home for her mother's funeral. Once again, Mary Veal found herself the aggressively unnoticed guest at a tense social gathering at the house on Rumney Marsh. Once again, she wore a hand-me-down wool dress that itched horribly and smelled like a closet. Her father was nowhere to be seen. The punch bowl provided the conversational focal point. Once again, her sisters were snubbing her. Once again, the hors d'oeuvres were lame. Mum's funeral notwithstanding, she reflected, it felt just like old times. From behind her plaid wingback readout, she watched as her older sister, Regina, ruddy hair yanked flat by a headband and thinner than her usual thin, listlessly orbited the downstairs. Her younger sister, Gabby, hunched on the piano bench, wearing a tight navy pantsuit that made her look like a down-and-out real estate agent. Gabby picked vacantly at the paper plates of grapes and salmon mousse Triscuits. She appeared, Mary thought, in need of an awkward social encounter with an estranged family member. A wary Gabby clocked Mary's approach with her green-brown mum eyes. "Nice suit," Mary offered. "Mum's," Gabby said through a mouthful of grape. "It fits you," Mary said. She fingered the empty candy dish atop the piano, its circumference encircled by a green ribbon. "Except for the pants and the jacket." "Humph," said Gabby. "It fits nicely around the wrists," Mary said. The two of them wordlessly observed the arriving guests clot into special interest groups around the punch bowl. Mum's sister Helen and their handful of local cousins, Mum's Historical Society co-workers, Mum's Wesley College Alumni Association friends, Mum's Semmering Academy PTA colleagues. Regina competed one last enervated rotation and dropped onto the piano bench beside Gabby. She folded her legs and coiled her left foot around her right ankle, a holdover gesture from adolescence. She'd claimed once to Mary that this tourniquet pose helped stave off weight gain, at least in the leg area, which seemed about as reasonable as believing in the slimming powers of the electric massage belt. Mary remained determined to forge an emotional connection with her sisters. "How about that sermon," Mary said, referring to Reverend Whittemore's selection from the New Testament, "for one believes he can eat all things, but he who is weak eats only vegetables." Offered, she suspected, as biblical proof that their mother's subsistence diet of white wine and pickles had been a more decisive element in her demise than the melanoma. "He reads that sermon every funeral," Regina said. "Once he called the dead person, who was a man, beloved Phyllis." Gabby yawned. "Do you remember in junior choir how Reverend Whittemore smelled like embalming fluid?" Regina said. "The old perv was always hugging me after we sang praise him, saying, 'How the heavens applaud you, my dear.'" "Blick," Gabby said through shards of Triscuit. "At least Aunt Helen almost made it through her poem without crying," Mary said. She didn't mention Regina's poem written specifically for Mum's funeral. The most truthful response she could muster as she and Regina and Gabby waited for Dad to bring the car around after the service had been, "It was so brave of you to read that." "Or plugging her herbal grief tea," Regina said. "I thought Healthy Acceptance filed for bankruptcy," Mary said. "Dad bailed her out, which is why we have 17 cases of grief tea in the attic," Regina said. "Where have you been?" "Oh, right, you were out west." "When Aunt Helen cries," Mary said, ignoring the dig, "I wonder how anyone can appear convincingly sad." "Which I guess explains why you didn't even bother to try," Regina said. "Gabby, where'd you get that awful suit?" "Mom's closet," Gabby said. "Is grief tea supposed to make you feel grief or not feel it?" "Not feel grief," Mary said, "I think." "That's not Mom's suit," Regina said. "Mom hated navy." Regina turned her suit coat inside out to reveal a green ribbon tied to the dry clean only tag. Their father had donated the house's contents to the Historical Society for auctioning, and an overly apologetic, volunteer had come around the previous day to tag the desirable items with ribbons. To be safe, the volunteer had overdone the job, or maybe, given she knew the wake was to be held at 34 Rumney Marsh, saw herself doubling as decorator for the occasion. All four legs of the couch were adorned with ribbon, both andirons, both candlesticks, the lamp bases and the lamp shades, and even the spare box of light bulbs. Every individual kitchen item, egg beater, potato masher, potato peeler, wine key, the collection of circa 1979 to 1983 Associations of Descendants of the American Witch newsletters stacked beneath the rattan coffee table. "So," Regina said, "speaking of not feeling grief, has anyone checked on Dad recently?" "I'll go," Mary offered, relieved to escape the hostile tedium of her sister's company. It depressed her too intensely and made her feel abrased by an all-body loneliness. She passed through the living room, her mobile presence registered only by the way the guests she neared strived to more actively ignore her. She split the curtains behind the punch table, expecting to see her father, Clyde Veal, still stationed on the front lawn, directing parking. but he'd abandoned his post. Since his departure, guests had parked along the north side of the street, ignoring the flyers he'd taped to the street lamps in order to avoid the territorial wrath of the neighbor Mum had christened Ye Old Bastard. Eventually, she found him, fingers pittering against his key-filled pockets, waiting in the foyer to receive coats, even though people had long since stopped arriving. "Dad," she started to say, but the two of them had pointedly arranged never to be alone without a chaperone since her arrival, so, in fairness to him, she chose to check on Dad from behind the broken grandfather clock. He opened the door and peered down the street as if expecting a cavalcade of mourners to turn onto Rumney Marsh and invade the house in desperate need of a coat check attendant. Her father hadn't invited any of his work acquaintances from St. Hugh's today, nor any of his golf cronies from the public golf range, a non-selective, dress-code-free club overlooking a swamp that boasted among its members a gay couple and an acquitted child abuser. Her father maintained his connection with the local working-class community while respecting Mum's unspoken hope that these people never be invited to their house. So it was in deference to Mum, she assumed, that he'd failed to invite his friends. Or it was for some more complicated, self-defeating reason. Mary knew, without ever needing to be told, her father was a self-made, lonely man. She would tell her sisters, when they asked how he was, "Dad is Dad." This diagnosis, transferably applicable to all of them, they would understand. Mary returned to the living room, dodging the two hors d'oeuvres platters wielded at her neck height by the waspy widowed caterers. Did even they refuse to see her? How many years had it been? A stupid question. She knew how many years. Everyone in the room knew how many years. 14 years to the day. The waspy widowed caterers offered toothpicks and colored finger napkins to the guests, who seemed relieved to be interrupted from their non-conversations. People emptied their cups of gin punch so that they could get a refill and have something to do. Not that funeral receptions were judged by the same standards as other social gatherings, but even given Mary's exceptionally low expectations for this event, it was proving to be a dud. Though not a regular smoker, Mary needed a cigarette. "Excuse me," Mary said to Fran Bigelow, Mum's tennis partner and a relentless chimney, currently hurrying past her en route to the bathroom. Mrs. Bigelow, such hand-eye, she remembered Mum marveling, sprung sideways as though Mary had attempted to stab her with an hors d'oeuvre fork. As Mrs. Bigelow continued to move in a diagonal vector at near-tripping pace, her heel caught in the loop of green ribbon extending from the handle of the decorative coal hod. Her heel acted like a catapult. Her next forward step hurled the coal hod into the fireplace, where the hod clearly picked off both andirons and landed on its side with a deafening crash. Conversations halted. "Whoopsie," Mrs. Bigelow said, staring damningly at Mary. Mary froze. She, who had been previously so invisible, was suddenly aggressively seen. Mum's Wellesley College Alumni Association friends, Mum's Simmering Academy PTA colleagues, Mum's Historical Society co-workers, the spouses, the distant cousins, all of them eyed her with a familiar probity. Exuberantly, she returned their gazes. She'd forgotten how enjoyable it was to dislike these people and was invigorated by the reminder. Cocktail parties notwithstanding, their preferred pastime was making others feel eternally shitty about themselves. These emotionally mummified, blank-eyed, sorry people, how easy it was to blame them for her troubles with her mother. How much easier it was to blame them than it was to blame a more deserving party, herself, for example. She rewarded the lot of them with a grotesquely buoyant smile. "Strike," she said. In the hallway, her father stifled a hiccup. Aunt Helen, 3, maybe 4 drinks into the afternoon, rushed from the kitchen, silk skirt thudding on the apparent wind, as she pincered Mary by the elbow and steered her to a vacant space near the punch bowl. A gossipy buzz engulfed them. "Not recommended today," Aunt Helen said. "Irreverence." "I couldn't help it," Mary lied. "It's what Mum would have said." Aunt Helen refilled her punch glass. Her wardrobe clashed as loudly as her interests in curative tea drinks and gin. A silk ikat skirt blandified by a gum-colored twin set and a gold frog pin from the local purveyor of preppy, the House of Walsh. "Also not recommended today," she said, presuming to speak for your mother. "You're one to talk," Mary wanted to say, but didn't. Aunt Helen was a shadowy pro at expressing her own feelings by attributing them to others. Usually she employed her standard poodle, Ouija, for this purpose. To wit, Ouija's feeling neglected today, isn't he? But today Ouija was with her neighbors and Aunt Helen needed a Ouija surrogate. Mary apparently fit the bill. Not that your extreme inappropriateness isn't understandable. You must be devastated, said Aunt Helen, refusing to see you before she died. But that's just so Paula, isn't it? She didn't give two hoots about anyone's feelings except her own. What can you expect from terminally ill conflict avoiders, Mary said lightly. The truth was she'd been blindsided by her mother's refusal to see her, expecting, as inane as it sounded, to share some sort of pablum closure moment with her in the Lillian P. Rudy Memorial Cancer Wing. As the candy stripers wept and the oncologist did a mournful soft shoe, and her mother, the most pablum-free individual on the planet, clasped her hand and said, "This is where the absurdity of her fantasy overrode the actual fantasy." Which didn't mean the failure of the fantasy to be met, to ever be met, hadn't left her feeling bludgeoned. You must be angry with her, Aunt Helen said. I imagine you're very, very angry. Aunt Helen widened her smudgy eyes tellingly, then shudder gulped rapidly in succession before appearing to cease breathing altogether. She released Mary's elbow and waved at her. Mary stared bewildered until she realized Aunt Helen wanted her cocktail napkin. Aunt Helen exhaled loudly, using the napkin to dab at her tearless face. Across the room, Mary saw Regina and Gabby exchange a look that told her they were bonding over the hating of other people. Aunt Helen, Mary, even their own father, who had excused himself from his non-existent coat check duties. Now he was playing with a second cousin's baby beneath the portrait of Mum's eighth great-grandmother, Abigail Lake, a suspected witch executed at Gallows Hill in 1692 and yet to be officially pardoned by the state of Massachusetts, and, notably, the only item in the living room without a green ribbon. Baby as grief shield, Mary thought. No funeral should be without a baby. Her father bounced the baby on his knee. He fake-walked it across the carpet. He absentmindedly played with its left ear, squashing it in half and unsquashing it at seemingly intentional intervals, as though he were sending Morse code to a guest across the room. She watched as Regina approached her father and asked him if he'd like another punch. He smiled toward a longitude of unoccupied airspace. He'd been smiling at no one in particular since he woke up that morning, surrounded by an aggressively chipper force field that repelled all attempts at human connection. Maxie and Susan, Mum's former Wellesley roommates, and the only two people Mary had been pointedly avoiding herself that afternoon, stood proprietorially to the left of the portrait of Abigail Lake. The portrait, frequent target of family scorn and the only item, according to her will, that Paula Abigail Bowden-Veal had left to her three daughters, was painted to look like an antique but was in fact less than 10 years old. Inspired by a passage Mum found in a diary describing her great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother's walk to the gallows. Flat and gray of eye, the diarist wrote, expressionless mouth in which the words of a pretty devil lurk. The painting was a money-making scam, in Mary's opinion, cooked up by Susan's feminist artist daughter, a former classmate of Mary's at Summering Academy, who offered, for an absurd fee, to paint portraits of the gallows victims to, quote, honor those who have so long been dishonored. Susan's daughter had interpreted the diary description of Abigail Lake to produce a woman who, according to Regina and Gabby, resembled nobody so much as she resembled Mary in a bonnet. Maxie held a paper plate of grapes. Susan nursed a sweating glass of seltzer. Both women were rickety and unseasonably brown, their chests and arms so sun-spotted they appeared upholstered in a miniature leopard print. They flashed Mary grins so intense that it only confirmed her formerly paranoid suspicion that they'd been discussing her. "How's life in Montana?" asked Maxie. "Oregon," corrected Susan. "You moved to Oregon?" said Maxie. "She's always lived in Oregon," said Susan. "You're still a waitress?" asked Maxie. "She's a secretary," said Susan. "I work at a private girls' school," Mary said. "Do you?" said Maxie dryly. "That's odd," said Susan. Silence. All three looked at Clyde, holding the baby upside down by the ankles, yelling, "Adios, little moon man." Then, "Terrible about the obituary," said Susan. Mary assumed they were referring to the headline, "Daughter of Early American Witch Dies." She hadn't read more than that. So tasteless, said Maxie. Newspapers can't pass up an opportunity for scandal, said Susan, referring to her as Miriam's mother, the gall of those people. Mary blanched, Miriam's mother. That book ruined her life, Maxie said tonelessly. And such exquisitely bad timing for the funeral, Susan said. 14 years to the day, Maxie said. Imagine the coincidence. Susan and Maxie's skulls quivered atop their reedy necks like the tips of dowsing rods, veering toward hidden watery areas under the green-ribboned Persian. Mary noticed people checking their watches and the other guests as if searching for a silently agreed-upon cue that they'd mourned enough in their bucked-up way and were allowed to go home for dinner. Mary faked a coughing fit and pointed at her throat with one hand while miming a drinking gesture with the other. She escaped to the punch bowl where there was no more punch and where her fake coughing fit intensified into an actual coughing fit. Eyes watering, Mary hurried toward the kitchen for a glass of water, but was stopped in the foyer by Aunt Helen. Ouija's tired, Aunt Helen announced, her words punctured. She'd retrieved her vase from the mantel, having transferred her sister's ashes to the silverware drawer. After informing Mary of Paula's new whereabouts, she grasped Mary's wrist with a cadaverish hand. Mimsy, she said. When she pronounced it like that, mimsy, nasal and high-pitched, Mary was reminded of Regina's favorite childhood goad, that her nickname was not a sweet diminutive inspired by her early life littleness. In fact, it came from Lewis Carroll's Jabberwocky and was a hybrid concoction of flimsy and miserable. After all this time, darling, you really shouldn't blame yourself, Aunt Helen said. Your mother got over it. I mean, yes, for many years she thought you did it to her on purpose. But you were young and unaware that anyone existed in the world but you. We all knew you didn't mean any intentional harm. Outside, Mary heard the rhythmic swell and ebb of Ye Old Bastard's leaf blower. I mean it, Aunt Helen slurred. I think we can all stop catering to Paula's every little whim now that she's... I mean, look at your father. Just look at the man. He hasn't had a whim of his own since he married her. If her father was a man impervious to whimsy, Mary thought, her mother could hardly be blamed. No two words less belonged in the same sentence than whimsy and father. Paula did have a talent for sucking up all the desire in the room. That's why everybody loved her, isn't it? Because she was so commanding and grand and aristocratically needy while appearing to need nothing at all. It's a wonder my life is floundering. It's no wonder I never learned how to want with Paula as my older sister. But I forgive her. I mean, I forgave her. So you had a talk with her, Mary said, before she died. Talk, Aunt Helen cast a persecuted glance toward the living room. Can I tell you a secret? Mary nodded, even as she wondered, whoever says no to that question, and is the result ever worth the buildup? Of course I loved her and forgave her all her controlling devious flaws, but Ouija knew better than anyone what a bitch she was, my darling. She pretended to love poodles, but Ouija saw right through her. She was really a terrible liar, you know. Fooled absolutely no one, dear heart, except maybe you. Aunt Helen held a finger to her rouged lips that were red now only in the creases. She smiled, and the remaining color bloomed wide, and Mary, in her slightly disoriented state, was made to think of the unexpectedly bright undersides of the wings of certain birds. Aunt Helen smothered her in a ginny embrace before teetering off toward her station wagon, parked beneath one of her father's do not park flyers. As the lingerers lingered, Mary stepped outside to smoke one of the two cigarettes she'd nicked from a guest's overcoat and walk around the neighborhood. She received a few sympathetic waves from neighbors out with their Yorkies, but was ignored by Ye Old Bastard, reversing out of his driveway in a beige Cadillac that featured a single bumper sticker, "Take Umbrage." The sticker referred to the 1983 town council election between Harold Clark and Sally Umbrage, an election handily taken by Clark after a newspaper revealed that Umbrage's campaign was funded by a historical amusement park developer with his eye on West Salem's sleepy waterfront. Take Umbrage. Mary had seen this sticker hundreds of times and read nothing more than a clever campaign pun. But today, on this day, the day of her mother's funeral, Ye Old Bastard's chrome bumper prickled with rebuke. She, Mary, was too accepting, too flimsy, and too miserable. A more committed sister would have appeared beseechingly weak in front of her sisters and begged for the comfort she so clearly wanted from them. A more committed daughter would have demanded to be seen by her dying mother. A more committed griever would have been racked by the injustice. She would have thrown herself atop the gravesite, had there been a gravesite, and howled into the dirt until the medics arrived. Take umbrage. She could not. She could not take umbrage. She was too long dull in the heart.